Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference, or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today I talk to Bill Hewlett of the Guelph Backgrounder. This is Hewlett's second time on the show. He first appeared on the Politicast way back in episode number 59, so a year and a half seems like a good time to catch up and chat again on the record about the media landscape in Guelph, political news, where we stand on the issues, and what might be happening in the near future with a municipal election in the fall. So getting some background with the Guelph Backgrounder is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. As you may recall, the Guelph Backgrounder is another crowd-funded independent media enterprise in Guelph, but with a very unique mandate. Instead of covering the day-to-day news of the Royal City, Hewlett creates monthly long-form features that heavily research a topic or issue of importance to Guelph. It's not unusual to have the root causes of issues being dealt with today date back years, if not decades. Where does one get that institutional knowledge? How do you even begin to gather it? That is the mission of the Guelph Backgrounder. The Guelph Backgrounder himself, Bill Hewlett, is a political animal with long teeth. He's run for office several times over the years, but he has mostly worked as a political activist and organizer. In 2016, he turned his attention to journalism in the very specific venue of the Guelph Backgrounder. And in the last 2 years, he's broken down the complicated history of hydro bills, Walmart, local boards, the OMB, and most recently, housing and solid waste. He may only publish once or twice a month, but an awful lot of work goes into crafting those posts. It's a one-stop shop for knowledge and insight into the way things are in Guelph on several key issues. So this week on the Guelph Politicast, we catch up with Hewlett to hear about the latest from the Backgrounder, his success building the site, and some of the insights he's gleaned from his impeccable research on such complicated topics. We also talk about the good old days of the Green Party. Hewlett ran twice for Guelph's provincial seat as the Green Party candidate, the same one that was just won by Green Party leader Mike Schreiner, so it's interesting to hear his insights and experience on how the Green Party got from there to here. And finally, we will also talk about the upcoming municipal election and whether or not it will be a contentious one. So I caught up with Bill Hewlett earlier this week in studio. So Bill Hewlett, thank you so much for rejoining me today. It's been almost 16 months or 18 months since we last had a sit down chat like this, although we meet casually in public. I don't want people to assume that there's some sort of Politico background or rivalry, that we are persona non grata in public. We see each other around.
Wow. I mean, I always try to encourage indie media wherever.
So what I've noticed on the Backgrounder this year is you've tackled issues so big, it requires more than one article. It requires, it's not like your style and what you do is tied to brevity, but you're dealing with waste collection and housing prices, and these are issues so big that they require multiple posts.
Yeah. Part of that was people were complaining the some of the posts were too long, so I broke them up into multiple posts, and they quickly expanded to the size of the original posts I was trying to break up.
It's like the Hobbit movies.
Yeah.
You start with two, and then you get three, and so it's we're both sort of involved in the indie media experiment. So I feel like I'm doing all right. How do you feel you're doing?
Well, I'm on a pretty good curve. I'm on a learning curve for marketing. Mm. I found that I hate marketing, but.
Yeah,
it works, and I hate social media, and I find that marketing
it works,
so I got to do it. The other things that kind of really surprised me was the response I've been getting from certain parts of the municipal government.
Oh yeah,
I was at an event on Saturday night, and I was handing out business cards, marketing. Guelph Backgrounder, I handed one to this woman, and her husband shows up, and he sees the card and says, "Oh, yeah, I love the Backgrounder. I read it all the time."
Yeah, yeah.
And then another person I was with said, oh, what do you do for a living? He says, oh, I work at City Hall. I'm head of a department. And it's like, oh, yeah, that explains that.
Yeah.
Turns out the staff love my blog.
Oh, good.
And, you know.
Or bad. I mean, if you kind of want to rile things up. But I mean, that's not your necessarily your direction. But I guess it reinforces that, at least on one perspective, you are representing the history of issues well, that if people are learning that and engaging from that.
Well, I've never been... Some people seek out controversy. I've, in the past, had controversy thrust upon me. But it was just a vote of confidence. This guy was saying, I do this for a living and I learn stuff from your blog.
Yeah, so yeah.
This is good, you know? Another thing I found out is people are starting to use it as a resource for community building.
Mm.
So there was a group organizing against the giant glass factory that's organizing in the South, and I think it's the South or whatever.
Yeah. Well, it's outside of town, but the prevailing winds and such have people concerned, and plus the water use and all that, because it's right next door.
But the point is, I noticed that one of the organizers was saying, hey, look at this blog article about gravel, which is parenthetically about the moraines and water aquifers and things like that in Guelph. So, and then there was another person who's running for City Hall, and she's saying, you should read this article about housing because it's, you know, it gives you an idea of what's going on here. So that was the idea of doing this, was to fill the void that the Mercury actually never filled, and then when it was gone, it was whatever. But also just to empower and encourage and educate the public. Because, you know, I'm a political activist more than a real journalist, but I've sort of, again, some people seek out journalism and some people have journalism thrust upon them.
Very true. The history component and, you know, going back on the issues is, it's interesting that something I've found too, and I did a podcast with June Hoffland about the Lafarge site, about the history of the activism there and how it went from, you know, this thing that was just this empty tract of land that suddenly was the lightning rod of controversy, and then going up all the way to, this was a couple of weeks after they cut down all the trees there. But people have revisited that a lot, because I think in so much as we always talk about Guelph as a growing community, we forget that people are coming into a community without the, you know, the background, the institutional knowledge of, you know, moving into an area where there may be issues and not knowing what the root of those issues are, or, you know, perhaps, you know, picking up a baton where someone might have dropped it, you know, something like the Lafarge area where there was no news on it for years, and all of a sudden signs go up and say, oh, we're cutting down all the trees. And you know, half the people in that area were new and were like, well, what the hell is this?
Well, this is the thing. There's a lot of land around here that's been land banked, and people buy houses and they figure, oh, wow, this must be public land.
Yeah.
Well, no, it isn't. It's somebody's just waiting until the price is right to bulldoze everything and build on it. And this happens time and time again. It's going to happen over at the new property at Clare Road?
Right. Yeah. Clare Maltby,
yeah. And again, that's owned by developers. Mm-hmm. You know, big slugs of it were bought a long time ago. But, you know, people see trees and, you know, hills and stuff like that. Oh, wow, nature. Well, not for long.
So, you know, talk about the, you know, developing the housing, because, you know, or the that topic. Because I feel like this is, I mean, there's an undercurrent to housing, I think, where we kind of just see the micro, which is how much a house costs and how much people can spend and what the interest rates are, and there's that part of it too. But there's also so many different tendrils going into it. There's like provincial demands. There's the history of the area. There's you know, the waiting list, social housing, types of housing that can be built, you know, trying to wrap your head around it is just daunting. The whole idea of it is daunting. So where did you begin?
Well, first I, well, a little try to split it into bits and parts. I've wanted to do housing for a while, but as you say, it's kind of daunting. And what came to a head was a friend of mine who lives in social housing was all in a flutter because the management had just arbitrarily told them that they're going to have to start paying for their laundry facilities all of a sudden. And the going rate that they were buying new machines and sticking in card readers and you had to buy cards and blah, 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 all that stuff. And it was going to cost less than going down to the laundromat. But people living on rent geared to income have very little disposable income.
Right.
And this was a big deal to these people, you know. So, you know, she was freaking out. There was petitions being sent around, and she was asking me, well, who owns the buildings? And, well, you know, that's a search. And then it turns out, oh, well, you know, social housing is all governed by the county instead of the city, even though most of the social housing is in the city.
Yeah.
Now it's a political decision. And as you say, there's federal and provincial housing money. And, you know, it's like pulling on a string on a knitted sweater. You just pull and pull and pull, and you think you're going to come to an end, but you just keep pulling more and more yarn out.
There's just more sweater.
Just more sweater. So so I got that, and then I started looking around at CMHC numbers, and then, well, that's rather interesting. Housing has tripled in price in the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And people's wages, well, a lot of people's wages haven't tripled over the years.
No.
But some people's wages have gone up dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And now then there's the amount of green fields that we can build on is gone because of concerns about preserving the water aquifers and preserving farmland and preserving, you know, this, that, and the other thing. We've got the green belt, which is important.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, like you say, there's a lot of different issues. And, of course, they're all turned to mud in my head right now.
But appropriately enough.
Yeah. But so, I pursued all these things. And like on Saturday night, I was yakking with the head of the emergency department at Guelph General.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about the interplay between homelessness and physical health. And he was talking about what he calls the frequent flyers. And then he started going on about, well, you know, it turns out Guelph paramedics are traveling around to social housing now to deal with people and help them with their issues, which, again, so health issues plug into housing on the lower end, and it's a very involved thing, and that's why it just spreads like an accordion or a telescope. You just got to keep working at it. And the value of doing things online is I don't have the same problem I used to have when I was writing for the Mercury, which was like, you've got 750 words. That's the size of your hole.
Yeah,
and I knew if I gave him 800 words, some ham-fisted editor would would ruin the story by doing bad edits in the 5 minutes she had to work on it.
Yes.
So I can just go nuts with these things.
Yeah. Does it ever give you ideas like to immerse yourself so deep in the issue? Like do solutions occur? Like are you seeing problems in a different way that perhaps someone like me who's just maybe covering the topic in a glossed over sort of way because it comes up at council or something, or you know, are we missing anything? Is there like, I guess, any point in the middle where the deep dives you do can meet the sort of overview things that, you know, I do or the Tribune does or the Today does?
Well, I'll give you something I've been thinking about recently.
All right.
I was in the Green Party and didn't say, well, I'm a journalist, so I can't do that now. I was a big fan of carbon taxes and putting a price on pollution and using market mechanisms. And in my article about solid waste, I found out that's basically what the Liberal government was trying to do. And they had this very ambitious program set up to control solid waste through market mechanisms. And that was part of actually, the conservatives had started something like this. And so if you go back through historically, through Mike Harris and then Dalton McGuinty and then Kathleen Wynne, I would notice the backlash of the business community and the sleazy tricks they pulled to undermine any attempt to use market mechanisms to control solid waste production. Just crazy crap, you know, and just no interest whatsoever in the public good at all or trying to work with the minister or anything like that. And that kind of sort of weakened my support. And maybe it is, you know, short of having green police who start, you know, pulling people out and putting bullets in the back of their heads, you know, some sort of Stalinist green Cheka. Sometimes I wonder if, like, there are just always going to be aspects of the business community that will move heaven and earth to try to destroy any attempt at environmentalism. That's kind of a... So it undermined my sort of... a sort of naive faith in market mechanisms.
Right. I mean, I've been around in Guelph long enough to remember how angry wet dry made people, the conversion to wet dry, just the two streams, that, you know, people were outraged about it. And not necessarily business. I'm sure there was business. I mean, I was kind of new to Guelph at the time, so I wasn't familiar with the players, but I just remember the anger. That, like, how dare you make me want to put my compost in a separate thing?
Yeah, I remember that. I originally wanted to write an article about how the wet dry came about because people forget about why we have a wet dry. We have a wet dry because our landfill was filling up.
Yeah.
And we had this screwball system in the province where it was very much discouraged. I'm told it wasn't illegal, but it's very much discouraged to put landfills on Class A agricultural land.
Mm.
And the problem is the best place to put a landfill is on Class A agricultural land. It's flat. It has a clay base that controls leachate, blah, blah, blah.
Mm.
And in southern Ontario, if you take out the Class A agricultural land, all you have left are wetlands.
Mm.
And you really shouldn't be building on wetlands, and that is really discouraged, if not illegal.
Yeah.
So the city hired all these consultants to find a place that wasn't Class A agricultural land or a wetland, and all they did was find spaces where the survey wasn't done properly.
Okay.
So they do a literature search, and they go out and, that place that says it's not a wetland has a big beaver pond on it. Or that place that's not described as Class A agricultural land has 100 acres of soybeans and corn on it. So they spent a lot of money on that. And at the same time, there were some fast-talking salespeople who showed up and they, you know, did the monorail speech from The Simpsons, only this was incinerator.
Yeah.
And they were going to incinerate the garbage. And at that time, it would have been a total disaster because the technology wasn't up there.
Right.
And we would have had this smokestack sending dioxins and furans all over the province. And then the government would have stepped in and said, you got to shut that down. And then we would have been back to square one again, having thrown away a whole bunch of money.
Yeah.
So, but what happened was there was a guy at Oberg. People don't know this. There was a guy at Oberg, worked full time. Several guys working together. And they did all the research that the staff should have done.
Mm.
And they came up with a very professional process. Some of them almost worked themselves to death. I'm told one of them basically was fainting. He was from lack of sleep and overwork. And they came up with this proposal in front of city council, which were not the most progressive green people in the world at that time. And they basically said, okay, you can do this. They do this in Europe. And these other things are just crazy wastes of money. And they convinced city council, okay, we're going to do this.
Mm.
And that's why the wet dry came about. Mm. It wasn't social engineering by greens and leftists and Oberg types. It was it was the only real response to the situation. Now, there was another landfill site that eventually came up, but by then the city had just decided, okay, we're going to go with this. Yeah. You do the wet dry. And it's immensely popular with the majority of people in this city. It, you know, people take it as pride that they sort their garbage, or at least they used to. And but there's this lump of the population that resents environmentalism.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. I mean, one of the problems is that we all live in these self-selected silos. We don't get to talk. We tend to hang around people of like mind. And a lot of, there are people in this group that just will not tell you what they really think about things.
Hmm.
You know, they'll say things when you're not around. It's sort of like, I notice this a lot where I work, is there are times I'll walk into a room and people will see me and then they'll just stop talking. Or the guys will come in and needle me about something and say, Bill won't like this. Okay, well, sure.
If you say so.
Yeah.
You brought up running for the Green Party, and you ran for the Green Party twice here. I guess we could say before it was cool.
Well, I ran for the Green Party a lot more than twice.
Okay.
Or six times.
Okay, well, I guess I'm just thinking back to when Guelph was, the riding of Guelph, which was around 87.
Well, it was 88 the first time I ran. But I ran in Guelph municipally, federally, and provincially. Municipally, federally, and provincially. So covered all the bases.
But you did twice for provincial, and I wanted to get your thoughts because now we have a Green MPP in Guelph. And I realized that perhaps the Green Party looks a bit different in 2018 than how it looked in 1988. But, I think we could reasonably say you laid that groundwork 30 years ago.
Well, this was something I would say to the people in the Riding Association over and over again. We're not going to win. We're here to raise the issues. We're here to build the foundations and train people on how to do things. And we're also here to do, there's a lot of things you can accomplish without being elected.
Mm.
And
which is something Mike Schreiner ran on.
Well, Mike, I don't know if he still says this, but Mike Schreiner actually says or has said in the past that he got involved and he would read my blog about Green Party theory, which that's what got him sort of enthusiastic about the thing, or somebody told him to read it, and that was the introduction. But, you know, when I first joined the party, it was insane. The federal too, but let's talk provincially. The provincial constitution governing meetings followed, they called it formal consensus, but actually if you know anything about political theory, it's what's known as the Polish parliamentary system, which means everybody who shows up at a convention has an absolute veto over the majority. One person blocks something, it doesn't pass.
Mm-hmm.
There was no delegate system. There was no scrutiny of credentials. People were showing up and blocking proposals that weren't even party members. People would show up. There were riding associations with one or two people, and that was it. That's always been the way. Nobody would join these riding associations because these people were lunatics.
Yeah.
And I got the, through Sturm und Drang and various things, I managed to get the provincial constitution changed so that it has a much more reasonable mechanism of decision-making. And I also got a delegate system brought in where people bring in proxy votes. So if you have a really strong riding association, you can bring enough proxy votes and you get a huge influence on the party. If you're one or two people, you just have your own vote.
Yeah.
And there was wailing and gnashing of teeth about this. But I remember one of the conventions after we got the proxy votes passed, Guelph and another riding association had showed up at the convention with two little tables in the corner of the room, and we had enough proxy votes to just to pass resolutions opposing everybody else,
who
were basically just guys who showed up and never did anything.
Mm.
And that's when the party really started changing in a significant way.
Mm.
And locally, I spent a lot of time cross-training people. So like I'd say, okay, you be the chief financial officer this time around and you do this. And then next time around was you be the chief financial officer and you do the science and you do this and you do that. It's a lot easier to do when you've only got a few people running, but you end up with everybody getting a feeling for how to do various things. We also organized campaigns. I was at an event the other day, and I was introduced by somebody. Oh, that's Bill. You may not believe it, but Bill dressed up, and he put a styrofoam container on his head and danced in front of McDonald's. And, you know, what we did was we had McDonald's was organizing McDonald's was using CFCs.
Right.
HCFC 11, I think it was, as a blowing agent for styrofoam clamshells for their hamburgers and things.
Yeah.
And they were basically telling people that this was ozone-friendly packaging material.
Yes.
Which it wasn't.
Yeah.
And so we organized through the chapters, because by that time we had chapters in various places that actually could get boots on the ground, and we brought together eight demonstrations across the province. Now, the top-level media froze us out, so there was nothing in the Star, the Globe, or the Sun had something. But the second-tier papers, they gave us front-page coverage. We got clips on the local TV stations. The CBC didn't cover it. We got the front page of the Canadian Packaging trade publication, which is important. And we managed to get McDonald's to stop using
the CFCs and the...
And the clamshells altogether. They switched to paper, so you don't have clamshells all over the place.
Right.
And on the basis of that, people were leaking me documents. And it turns out McDonald's at the time was gearing up to have in-house incinerators. So, like, every McDonald's would have their own incinerator to deal with solid waste. And they had a cartoon character, Archie McPuff. was going to be the cartoon figure when they unveiled this.
Right.
And so, you know, things like that. And then I got...
It makes sense because there's already a burglar character in McDonald's. There should be an arsonist too. Yeah.
Well, and then at that time, the first McDonald's were opening in Russia, and we got contacted by the Moscow Greens, and they were, like, horrified by the amount of solid waste being produced by this McDonald's. The whole municipal system was not – it wasn't a zero-waste society, but they didn't have the wealth to just throw crap away like we do here.
Right.
So they were – the municipal government was just, like, what are we going to do with all this stuff? So, you know, people were sending me stuff like this. And you can accomplish a fair amount just being part of an international organization, even if you don't have anybody elected. So another example is after the revolution against Ceausescu in Romania, the Romanian Greens contacted us. And well, they had a CANDU reactor that Ceausescu had been building with slave labor.
Right.
And the government inherited this dinosaur. What are we going to do with it? So they decided they were going to finish building this nuclear reactor. And the Greens were saying, Do you have any expertise about this? It is a Canadian design. And it turns out we had a member. I found a member who, I found the Canadian Nuclear Alliance, connected them with them. And I also found a member who was an engineer who had helped design the safety features on one of the nuclear reactors, which is kind of horrifying because she worked on the safety features and then became an ardent anti-nuke person. And I asked her, like, you helped build this thing. Why are you opposed to this and nobody else? And she said, well, it's very easy to support something when they back a dump truck up and fill your driveway with money, which is basically what they did to anybody who worked on these things. So... And then another time, we had the head of the Green Party of Ireland, Trevor Sargent, came to Guelph, and we organized a fact-finding tour, and he went through the wet-dry facility and stuff like that. So I really tried to encourage people to believe that you can accomplish a lot without being elected, and that election campaigns parties are marathons. They're not sprints.
Right.
You know, later on as we got bigger and there was, like, people started saying, well, we can win if we just work harder. And I'd say, no, do that, you'll burn out the volunteers. And after the election, when you lose, they'll quit and never come back again. And nobody ever listens to me. And then, you know, you got to the certain size, and then we had this meeting, and I said, okay, now, do we want to continue doing the activist-y thing, which is our building our base and building the community, or do we want to just focus on elections? The unanimous decision at the breakfast meeting was, we just want to focus on elections. Oh, okay, well, I believe in democracy, and I always, you know, the sorts of people who start things, entrepreneurs, are not the sort of people who go to the finish line.
Right.
Moses never went to the promised land.
Yeah.
And I knew that getting going is that the more successful I was building the Riding Association and the Green Party, the sooner the day would come when there was no place in it for me. And that's fine. You move on and other people take it over and it moves on. And then you go to the next thing, which for me was suing Walmart.
Right.
And then... that had its own dynamic, and now
that's a whole other podcast.
Yeah, now I'm doing the backgrounder. So,
yeah. Do you think that, you know, being now an outside observer, do you think that there's room to build, or do you think that, you know, it's because I think we look at what happened at the federal level, right? It was a similar strategy with Elizabeth May, where Elizabeth May got elected in Sandwich Gulf Islands, and the presumption was, okay, well, we can carry that over to have one or two more people elected. And I think the Green Party is looking at a similar strategy. But, you know, can that work?
I think there's a very big difference between the Green Party of Canada and the Green Party of Ontario.
Okay.
You know, I'm a member of both in organizations, and I really don't, I'm not totally, my finger's not on the pulse, but I'm trying to say this nice. But the thing about Mike Schreiner is that I went to the volunteer appreciation thing on Saturday that they had at the Red Papaya, and he pushed all the right buttons. He said, we're going to keep having volunteers. We're going to continue to do community organizing and building. And
because he looks like he's still campaigning.
Well, that's what you have to do.
Yeah.
And it's, he has to keep building the community. You have to keep building. Otherwise, the thing will fall apart.
Mm.
And there's this thing called parliamentary cretinism, where people...
Sounds great.
Yeah, an old Marxist term. And it's basically all the revolutionary energy of the people gets dissipated in the games playing in parliament. Now... Parliament's useful, but you should be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. You should constantly be building your base at the same time that you have the elected officials doing stuff. I'm a little bit concerned that the Green Party of Canada doesn't have that focus. It's sort of, you could almost say it's the Elizabeth May Party. And the reforms I talked about, the changes to... how voting and how things in the Ontario, the delegate system and stuff like that, the Green Party of Canada went in a different direction. Mm-hmm. They're more into online voting and stuff like that. I'm not a fan of online voting because you don't build strong riding associations. You have a bunch of isolated people sitting in basements and making votes, and a lot of people don't really understand the people they're voting for and things like that. We had this moment, and I find in politics, people always want to take the easy route. They always want to find a famous person on a white horse that says, follow me. And then, oh, great, we just support this person and they do all the work and that's it. And that nothing ever changes that way. You've got to be in a long haul. You've got to make a personal commitment to make political activism part of your life.
Right.
The rest of your life, a chunk of your life, every day, every week. That's how the world changes. And that's too much for a lot of people to take. And it's, I'm sorry, but it just doesn't work any other way.
Right.
And the other thing is, especially with environmentalists, is environmentalists spend all their time reading Rachel Carson and Sand County Almanac and stuff like that, and they know nothing about politics.
Right.
And they're not interested in reading about politics. They're not interested in deferring to somebody who knows a little bit about politics and political organizing. So a lot of times they're just incredibly naive.
Mm.
I remember the one thing that used to come up a lot is people would say, well, the big problem is political parties. We just need to get rid of the political parties.
Right.
And it's like, and what do you think they should do? Well, just elect individuals, and then they just listen to the public.
Mm.
And it's like, well, you're not transitioning, you're not getting rid of parties. You're just taking a transparent structure where people know how it works and making an invisible structure where people get together and do things informally, and that's not an improvement.
Mm.
But that was lost on these people. They just get angry. Well, what do you know? Well, obviously not very much.
I want to wrap up by talking about the municipal election coming in the fall, because it's nomination's been open for almost 2 months, and we still have, I think we have multiple candidates in all the ridings so far, or at least two in each, but we don't have more than one person running for mayor, and it's the person who's currently running for mayor. And, you know, I remember the 2010 election where Karen Farbridge was running for re-election, and there were four candidates. There was Scotty Nightingale, who ran the projector at the bookshelf at the time. Mm-hmm. And there was Ray Mitchell, who was, you know, then on a tear because he was forced to give up the family thrift shop. And we had David Birtwistle, who was, I guess, the conservative voice, but wasn't really trying. And then we had the incumbent. And I'm wondering, is this, you know, part of that 8-year cycle that, you know, there's kind of a pro forma election, but, you know, where the incumbent is running against maybe two or three other competitors. But I mean, really, it does seem like unless something really drastic comes up, and I guess, you know, 2003 would be an example of that when Kate Quarry and 3/4 of the council were voted off. But it just seems like for the most part, we elect people for 8-year terms, not 4-year terms.
Well, it's 2 4-year, was it? Is it 4 years now?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, 2 4-year terms. It used to be 4 8-year terms.
Yeah.
I don't really know. I think it might be more a function of the weak mayor system we have municipally, which Dow help us. Doug Ford is opposed to for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
If we had a strong mayor system, this would be a much bigger deal.
Mm.
But Cam is, I didn't really like some of the things Cam said the first time he ran. But there are people that run on stupid things, and they stick with the stupid things. And then there are people who run on stupid things, and then they listen to people, and the stupid things just fall off the plate, and they start sounding a lot more reasonable.
Mm.
And I don't. I would generally think Cam fits in the last category.
Mm.
I think he will listen to reason, and I think he has to because he's only one vote in the horseshoe.
Right.
And those are very good things. I don't know. I mean, I try to avoid the partisan stuff where, you know, I don't like him. I'll never like him. I'll go to my grave not liking him. You know, it's like I was listening to an interview between you and him,
mm-hmm.
with my wife, who's up from the States. And she said, oh, I kind of like that guy. He made a lot of sense. And I was thinking, I'm not supposed to like him for some reason. Why don't I like him? Well, you know, I tend to defer to my wife. It's good to have a fresh view from someone you respect. So I like Karen Farbridge. I can never figure out why people hated her so much. I can't figure out why people hate Kathleen Wynne.
Yeah.
You know, it's like she did a lot of good things. It's like, you know, when you ask people, why do you hate Kathleen Wynne?
They can't put their finger on it.
No, it's because, let me get back to you.
Right.
It's like, oh, that's kind of sad, but okay. So maybe it's just nobody has just got the fire in the belly about Cam and just figures, well, okay, mm-hmm. he may not be my first choice, but I can live with him. And frankly, that's pretty good if you're a politician.
That's the sweet spot.
That's the sweet spot.
It just, you know, I think it's, you know, when I read political comments online, and I probably shouldn't, but it does seem to be split into a steady camp of, you know, they're doing a good job, or vote the bums out. And And I've seen that in reference to Mayor Guthrie, and it just makes me think, well, if you know, and maybe this goes back to some of the organizing points you're making, but you know, if someone's got you in this big of an uproar where you're like, no, they have to go, mm-hmm. well, somebody has to take their place. And where's the representative for the throw the bums out camp? I'm curious because you know, he is running unopposed right now.
Well, one of the projects I worked on years ago that actually got started Karen Farbridge on her political trajectory was this something with the, I wanted to call it Reform Guelph, but the Reform Party was a big deal then. So it,
yeah,
we had this convention and we came up with this horrible name, the Municipal Democracy Movement. But we ran a bunch of candidates and Maggie Laidlaw ended up on school board and we had an incumbent to join us. And it was a combination green NDP, progressive typed people. And we did pretty good, elected a couple people. And then that started the trajectory. And then we elected a few more people the next time around. And it was a big sort of thing. But I don't see that happening in Guelph now with municipal council, mainly because I think the council's working fairly good.
Mm.
You know, if you look at the numbers that people are getting, they're pretty good. And it really isn't a party system because people vote different ways back and forth. And so I think we could do a lot worse.
Mm. I think, yeah, as opposed to what some other people in town might say about, you know, groups of seven or groups of eight, it's, you know, I think there's fairly good consensus and those votes, the split votes are fewer and far between. But,
well, there's always a huge difference between informed opinions and uninformed opinions. I'll let people decide which group I fall into or and which group those people fall into.
That seems like a good place to leave it. So, Bill Hewlett, thank you so much for joining me, and keep up the good work on the background here.
And you keep up the good work that you do, too.
I will. Thank you. And once again, that was Bill Hewlett, and you can find the Guelph Backgrounder online at guelph-back-grounder.blogspot.com. You can also get Hewlett's book, Walking the Talk, Engaging the Public to Build a Sustainable World, both in ebook form at smashwords.com or in paperback at Lulu and the Bookshelf. And you can also find Hewlett on Twitter at CloudWalkingOwl. And that is it for this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics. It's Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at AdamADonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at AdamADonaldson. You can also go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph, and you can donate to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. If you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating. And if you don't want to donate to me, you can also donate to the Guelph Backgrounder too, and you can find that information on his website. I just wanted to add that too. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.